You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. This is part four of that series for 2009. Rick Britton introduces today's guest speaker.
We've got a great speaker tonight. He's a good friend of mine. He has done this talk. He has done talks for us before, 2 years. I think this is his third year running. Keith Gibson is the director of VMI Museum Operations. He's a great speaker. He's a good friend of ours here at the Senior Center. So please join me in giving a good welcome to Colonel Keith Gibson.
The topic for this evening and the subject of your trip, which sounds really fascinating, because the only way, as you well know, you've done this, the only way for you to really experience this is to get out there and to see the terrain and to walk the fields. But you have to start someplace, and so here we are. Drawing the Sword, Jackson at Cedar Mountain. When Stonewall Jackson, the real question mark is, did he or didn't he? For those of you that might know something about the battle, we'll talk about that mystery of the battlefield. Drawing the sword, did he or didn't he? When Stonewall Jackson marched into Gordonsville on 19 July 1862, he looked to the west. He looked to the Blue Ridge Mountains. He turned to his staff and he said, that reminds us of home. Perhaps Jackson hoped to draw strength from the mountains, as most of us tend to do. He had had a less than exceptional performance over the previous month, you might recall, in the swamps and flatlands and the rivers east of Richmond. Jackson now commanded the largest force of the war, some 24,000 troops. His soldiers, they were in good physical shape, although most of the regiments he was commanding were well below their normal strength. They had been fighting, you might remember, in the Battle of the 7 Days around Richmond. But their spirits were high that they were moving westward, returning to, as Jackson points out, returning to home. Jackson was once again in independent command, unlike his relationship in Richmond under Lee. He was now an independent command. In the battle that would soon take place, he would be, you could argue, at his best. But I will also argue that he was at his worst as well. In fact, the year of 1862 was proving to be quite good for the U.S. military efforts. Kentucky, Missouri, Western Virginia, all securely in Union hands. New Orleans had fallen. Tennessee was under heavy assault. In fact, things were looking so good for the Union in the early months of 1862 that Secretary of War Stanton ordered all the Army recruiting stations closed. They had enough men. This will be over soon. Thank you for your service. The Confederate government, at the same time, for the first time, had to resort to conscription to fill its ranks. We are going to impress individuals to do their duty. It was a very decision. Then, in the year of 1862, the spring, defying the laws of military dictum and mathematical averages, General Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson thwarts the efforts of three separate Union commands in the Shenandoah Valley over this period of 6 weeks, known as the Valley Campaign still yet today. John Fremont, Nathaniel Banks, and Irving McDowell. Now, you might be thinking, Irving McDowell, wasn't it Shields? Well, yes, it was Shields commanding the army in the field, but actually Shields was under the command of Irving McDowell's department. McDowell wasn't there, but he had sent his representatives under Shields to be there. Lincoln feared that Washington would fall prey to this pesky Confederate general before someone could be brought to the task of stopping him. Meanwhile, in far-off St. Louis, a 40-year-old major general named John Pope received an urgent telegram from Washington. Proceed to the War Department immediately. The president needs you. Born in Louisville, Kentucky, Pope's father was a lawyer and friend of Abraham Lincoln. Pope graduated from West Point in the class of 1842. One of his classmates was Pete Longstreet. He's commissioned into topographical engineers, which is a prestigious arm of the Army, certainly in the 19th century. Only the highest ranking officers, or standing officers, I should say, and the highest graduating officers from West Point were appointed into the topographical engineers. Pope saw service in the Mexican War, serving under Zachary Taylor at the battles of Monterey and Buena Vista, and he, like Jackson, was breveted twice for bravery in the face of the enemy. He served on the western frontier during the first years of the Civil War, and Pope brought his engineering talents to bear in April of 1862 when he captured Island Number 10. He had ordered a channel cut in the Missouri River, technically there, the Mississippi, thus isolating 12,000 Confederates and 58 cannon. This was a great prize for the Union. The fall of that Confederate position opened navigation to Union gunboats along this vital waterway as far as Memphis. Pope's success there and his family relationships with Lincoln and his penchant for making newspaper headlines with his braggadocious outbursts brought him to the attention of the War Department. Lincoln and his advisors had rightly reasoned that John Fremont, Nathaniel Banks, and McDowell, their recent failures against Jackson were partially due to the fact that they lacked a centralized command. The War Department decided to unify these three independent commands into a new army, an army commanded, or to be commanded, by John Pope, the Army of Northern Virginia. Now, not everyone welcomed that news. In fact, Fremont, the Pathfinder, Fremont had been presidential candidate in 1856, the first Republican presidential candidate. Fremont, under whom Pope had served in the West briefly, refused now to serve under a general that he personally despised. Fremont resigned his position. But waiting in the wings was Franz Sigel, who was brought in to command Fremont's old division. George McClellan didn't attempt to hide his surprise and disappointment in the news either. He felt that those men now in this new Army of Virginia could better be used under his command on the peninsula. After an exhausting and costly series of seven battles in as many days around Richmond, McClellan was stalled at Harrison's Landing, some 20 miles east of the Confederate capital. He could take that Confederate capital, he told Richmond. All I need is another 100,000 men. Instead, Washington ordered part of McClellan's command to join Pope's new army, bringing Pope's command to roughly 70,000 strong. Now, Pope brought an attitude of really unjustified self-assurance obvious to everyone but Pope, was offensive to these eastern blue-clad soldiers who had fought hard for the Union. "Let us understand each other," Pope declared in his particular manner. "I've come to you from the West, where we have always seen the backs of our enemies, from an army whose business has been to seek the adversary and beat him where he is found, whose policy has been to attack and not defend. I constantly hear of taking strong positions and holding them, of lines of retreat, of bases of supply. Let us discard such ideas. The strongest position a soldier should desire to occupy is one from which he can most easily advance against the enemy. Let us study the probable lines of retreat of our opponents and leave our own to take care of themselves. Let us look before us and not behind us. Success and glory are in the advance. Disaster and shame lurk in the rear." So says Pope. And you can imagine the enthusiasm that rang in his ranks. Well, these Westerman's proclamations proved to have the opposite of the desired effect on his command. When Pope went on to declare that his headquarters would be in the saddle, many Southerners concluded that a general who puts his headquarters where his hindquarters should be wouldn't be too difficult to defeat. Now, Lincoln has not one but two Union armies in Virginia, one on the banks of the James, less than 20 miles from the capital under McClellan down there in the corner, and the other spread out northwest to southeast in a line from Sperryville to Fredericksburg, respectively, a distance of about 60 miles. All totaled now, the Union forces in Virginia numbered right at 150,000. In an attempt to assure an overall unified command of these two armies, Lincoln appointed Old Brains Henry Halleck as supreme commander. Well, this move would do little to bring harmony, though, between Pope and McClellan, and they never really would get along too well. But it was not just the Union Army that was in a state of change. The Confederate forces were undergoing some significant adjustments as well. On 1 June of that year, Robert E. Lee assumed command of the 88,000 men surrounding Richmond in gray uniforms. Virtually unknown at that point to the Southern press, Lee changed the name of the army, one of his first moves, the Army of Northern Virginia, symbolically, he would call it. Lee devoted the first 10 days of his command to directing a huge entrenchment exercise and placing heavy artillery between Richmond and the Federal Army. It seemed the King of Spades, as the press called their new commander, would live up to his nickname. They wanted a fighting general, not a digger. During the 7 days battle, the last weeks of June, the first couple of days of July, Lee's army consisted of 11 divisions, awkwardly divided into three commands. One immediate result of the 7 days battles was to provide Lee with very important information he needed to reorganize and rid the army of less than productive generals. One comes to mind, General Whiting. Lee held a council of war after he takes command of the army he dubbed the Army of Northern Virginia, and he's asking all of his generals, very frankly, in a council of war, you expect the subordinates to tell you exactly what they think and bring fresh ideas to the table. They can be debated and maybe discarded, but someone might have the right idea. And you don't hold anything against anyone. It's a very free-flowing discussion. Well, in this process, General Whiting was asked what he thought of the prospects of the defense of Richmond, and, oh, it was doom and gloom. Failure is right around the corner. Oh, woe is us. We'll never be. And Lee kind of turned to his staff and said, Have General Whiting reassigned to an army away from Richmond, and he went off down to Wilmington, North Carolina. But this was not that Wilmington is a bad place in itself, but it wasn't Richmond. It wasn't the Army of Northern Virginia. So Lee is assessing his command structure in the wake of the 7 days. The results was a Confederate army organized into two wings. He would have liked to have called them corps, but the Confederate government didn't allow that term technically to be used. Two wings under Lee's best performers, Pete Longstreet and Tom Jackson. Lee retained an additional division under Ambrose P. Hill, which could support either Longstreet or Jackson as needed. "I want Pope suppressed," declared Lee. In language really uncharacteristic for Lee, he referred to the new Union commander as a miscreant. Referring to an order delivered by Pope regarding Pope's intentions towards civilians that might interfere with his movements, Lee instructed Jackson to restrain that man, restrain the atrocities which he threatens to perpetuate on our defenseless citizens. There was a personal resentment that Lee harbored against this braggart, John Pope. Pope's orders called for him to protect Washington from Confederate attack, cut off Southern access to the agricultural bounty of the Shenandoah Valley, and disrupt the rail supply of the Virginia-Tennessee and Virginia Central Railroads. Now, Pope, I think, rightly reasons that he could accomplish all of those missions by moving in the general direction of Charlottesville, by way of Culpeper, Orange Courthouse, Gordonsville. With some certainty that McClellan would remain immobile down on the James at Harrison's Landing, Lee decided to take the calculated risk, as he would do several times, as you know, during the war, to divide his army in the face of a superior enemy. He ordered Jackson's 12,000-man wing to move towards Gordonsville. The vital junction of the Virginia Central and Orange and Alexandria Railroads. On 19 July, Jackson's division under Richard Ewell and Charles Winder arrived there at the rail junction of the Virginia Central and Orange and Alexandria. A few days later, Lee sent A.P. Hill's 12,000-man light division to reinforce Stonewall. Now, Hill and Jackson are the proverbial vinegar and water cocktail. They would tussle back and forth, as did several people with Jackson. But Jackson would soon have reason to be very grateful for Hill's presence. A Stonewall, I think, rightly determined that Culpeper was the logical place for Pope to mass his forces. This is an 1862 photograph of Main Street. Jackson intended to strike an isolated portion of the new Union army before Pope could make that happen. With his army encamped around Orange Courthouse, Jackson waited for the Union army to move. He used the occasion, actually, to reconvene the court-martial of Brigadier General Richard Garnett, a situation I'm sure you know something about after your visit to Kernstown and what happened. This court-martial had been languishing ever since March at the outcome of the Battle of Kernstown. Now, witnesses and evidence seemed to be mounting in favor of Garnett when Jackson called an abrupt halt to the proceedings. Stonewall had just learned that Pope's lead divisions under Nathaniel Banks were nearing Culpeper. There was other business at hand. And oh, by the way, it's convenient for Jackson that we just sort of step away from the nasty Garnett situation for a while longer. And it would continue to languish even yet. Well, on the 7th of August, Jackson quickly dispatched orders to march towards that town. Ewell was to lead the column north, followed by A.P. Hill's division, with Charles Winder bringing up the rear. The army planned to cross the Rapidan on the 8th and be in Culpeper. And by the way, if you're looking at period maps, sometimes you'll see Fairfax, where you're supposed to be finding Culpeper. Up until about 1869, both of those names were used interchangeably, but because actually the postal system insisted that the name be changed because of confusion there. But you'll find Fairfax, where you're supposed to be finding Culpeper, on maps prior to that time. Jackson planned to cross the Rapidan, head towards Culpeper, and welcome Banks' division on the 9th of August. Now, sometime during the night, Jackson revised his marching orders. He now directed Ewell, by the way, was camped west on the banks of the Rapidan. He advised Ewell not to come back to Orange Courthouse, but to march directly to Bennett's Ford, where the entire army, Hill and Winder, would be crossing the river, where Ewell will cross the river. Instead of Richard Ewell crossing the river there, however, he said, no, march directly. Don't bother to come back to Orange Courthouse after all. Well, this made a great deal of sense. It shortened the line of march for Richard Ewell's troops on a day when the mercury would reach near 100 degrees. The problem was that no one told Hill about the change. Early on Friday morning, the 8th of August, after Richard Ewell had marched off pursuant to the new orders, Hill dutifully sat in Orange as he watched what he thought was Ewell's divisions passing down Main Street in front of him. Well, it turned out not to be Ewell at all, but it was Charles Winder's division and his excessively long wagon train, taking the entire day to pass through. Now the line of march was hopelessly confused and late getting started. If there's one thing you probably know about Stonewall Jackson, punctuality was at the top of his do list. You were always punctual. Lateness was not tolerated. By the end of the day that Jackson had hoped to be across the river, Hill's forces were only a mile or two outside of Orange. Ewell's exhausted troops arrived at Crooked Run Church around 2 p.m. on August the 8th and encamped for the night. He was 6 miles south or short of his ultimate destination, Culpeper. The following morning, near Locustdale, a frustrated Jackson paused to send a note to General Lee. "I'm not making much progress. Today, I don't expect much. I fear that the expedition will, in consequence of my tardiness, be productive of but little good." Now, blame for the confused marching orders and the bottleneck which ensued at the river crossing, further delaying Jackson's movement, rests squarely on Jackson, of course. He should have confirmed the orders with Ewell and Hill. In addition, Jackson should have ordered Ewell, who was well ahead of the rest of Jackson's command by the shorter route of march, to continue towards Culpeper on the Orange Culpeper Road, rather than waiting in the congested area around the river. Pope's men were suffering on the Culpeper Road as well. The new Union commander moved quickly to consolidate his troops. He ordered Franz Sigel to march quickly to Culpeper. Sigel, off to the west in Sperryville, telegraphed back to his commander asking, "Which route should you have me take?" Pope reminded Sigel, after consulting the map, that there was only one road between Sperryville and Culpeper, and that he should take that road. But Sigel's delay would significantly reduce the number of muskets that were available to Pope at the critical time where Pope anticipated meeting Jackson. In addition, Halleck, who had been warning Pope not to engage the enemy until all of your forces are marshaled, the march of Nathaniel Banks' division went smoothly, but the heat sent seasoned men into sunstroke and death long before the first bullets would be flung. Pope neglected to tell Banks to wait for the rest of the army, as Banks aggressively, somewhat unpredictably for his character maybe, but very aggressively moved south through Culpeper. Embarrassed and beaten in the valley just months earlier, Banks had a score to settle with Stonewall. With Union cavalry under the command of John Buford, and by the way, this sort of the first time in the war that you hear the name John Buford, that would become very recognizable by Gettysburg. But he's doing screening movements. He and George Bayard are screening the advance of Nathaniel Banks' division as it marches south out of Culpeper. The infantry, under Brigadier General Samuel Crawford, pressed down the Culpeper Road as far as Cedar Run, near the foot of Cedar or Slaughter Mountain. By noon of 9 August, more infantry under Generals Christopher Augur and Alpheus Williams arrived near Cedar Run Church, a building that still remains today that you'll see. The blue line extended about a mile and a half on each side of the Culpeper Road. And this is the base map that I've provided for you, the modern-day satellite version with some historical points placed in. But the blue line of Banks' troops extended in the approximate position, as you see there, near the Cedar Run Church, to a northwest to a southeast direction. Federal batteries opened up on the first Southerners under Ewell to come upon the road. Jackson and Ewell rushed up to assess the situation as artillery fire began to be exchanged. And in typical fashion for Jackson, he was determined to push through whatever Union troops were to his front. The key to the field, as will clearly be obvious to you when Rick guides you over there, and Rick knows this land in the most literal way, so you're in good hands for your trip to Cedar Mountain. But the key to that battlefield was Cedar Mountain, which the locals called Slaughter, appropriately enough Slaughter Mountain, poetically enough Slaughter Mountain, because of the family that lived at its base. Jackson would need several hours to get his 24,000 infantrymen deployed for battle. Currently, they were strung out along 7 to 10 miles along the single road leading to the battlefield. Jackson ordered... Yes? Do we have a dog in this fight? After Jackson, by the way, gave those orders for his troops to be disposed in this position along the Crittenden Lane, parallel to the Crittenden Lane, he went to Richard Ewell's headquarters and laid down on the porch and took a nap. Sounds like what the commanding general of an army dispatching itself for battle should be doing. Gently rolling land planted in corn and wheat separated the two opposing lines to the south of the Culpeper Road. To the north of the road, woods restricted visibility and maneuverability. This becomes critical to Jackson. A smaller field of wheat, circled there on the map, and brush located north of the Culpeper Road opened up just to the north of the Crittenton Farmhouse Gate. To the south of the gate along the Culpeper Road, the woods acted like a wooden palisade, which created a dangerous bottleneck restricting Confederate infantry movement. Jackson would have to resort to his regiments, his brigades, piecemeal sort of coming one after another on the battlefield. Sounds like Port Republic. It would become a critical place for Jackson. This place, the gate that leads to the farm lanes of the Crittenton home, and the woods that are restricting his motion until he gets basically to that gate where the field opens up. Most of his line would then take a right flank and join Ewell's troops here under Trimble. Now, Banks misinterpreted Jackson's slow movement onto the field as a sign of weakness. So the usually cautious Banks ordered a general infantry advance across Mitchell's Station Road. Such a move was in contradiction to Pope's verbal orders not to allow a general engagement. The blue line of Augur's command moved in good order across the Mitchell Station Road towards the Confederate position, parallel to the Crittenton Farmhouse, and up in this region where Confederate artillery would be placed. Banks had no more than 8,000 men of infantry at his disposal. His aggressiveness, I think, could have paid off had it come a couple of hours earlier. But by 3 p.m., mid-afternoon, there were enough Confederate artillery and infantry to blunt the Union advance. Jackson continued to strengthen his line throughout the late afternoon with the arrival of Jubal Early and Charles Winder's brigades. In an hour or two more, Jackson would have almost 20,000 men up on the line. Around 4 p.m., Confederate General 33-year-old Brigadier Charles Winder moved his division to the position near the Crittenton Gate. Now, Winder had been ill for several days prior to the battle. In fact, was carried to the battle by ambulance and then mounted to his horse. Soon, Winder found himself totally preoccupied by personally directing one of his artillery batteries positioned near the Culpeper Road, which is lined with split rail fence. Days when you visit, you'll stand at that point. As the ill general turned to shout a command, a Federal artillery shell tore through his left arm and mortally mangled his side. In a few hours, he would be dead. Command of the brigade devolved to William Taliaferro. Now, I know it looks like it's Taliaferro, but in Virginia, we say Taliaferro. And I should also tell you that also the family says Winder as in finder, not Winder as I sometimes am inclined to do. So please excuse me for that. When I say Winder, you think Winder. And I will try to say Winder. The Union advance faltered when Brigadier General Augur and Gary would fall, leading their commands across the Mitchell Station Road into the waiting infantry line, and more significantly into the artillery. That's just an ideal position, dominating the field here. Now notice what's happened to this end of Charles Winder's line. It is actually turned, creating a hook or L shape that is having insulating fire right into the Union regiments. That was too much, too hot for the Union line to stand, particularly in light of the fact that they have now lost two of their commanders, and the Confederacy has lost one, and that little part of the field in the late afternoon as the shadows are drawing across the base of a mountain that is truly earning its name, Slaughter. Shortly, it was at this juncture, about 6 o'clock that the emphasis of the battle would move to the northern end. Jackson's left flank would move to the northern end of the battlefield. Here's a, we'll zoom in on that particular part of the field. Union General Samuel Crawford was on the right end of the Union line, up in the upper right corner there, north of the Culpeper Road, and more significantly, concealed from the Confederate eyes, and advanced to the edge of that small wheat field. They crashed through the wood lines at the flank rear of court-martialed Richard Garnett's brigade, literally firing into the backs of the Confederates, who had to turn to advance these unexpected unions. Confusion ensued as hand-to-hand struggle for the Confederate left flank raged. The celebrated Stonewall Brigade, under the command of Charles Ronald at this point, had been ordered to support Garnett's left flank, but their arrival was delayed by the dense foliage that they were trying to march through. And for the only time in its career, parts of the famed Stonewall Brigade broke and began to move to the rear. Primarily men of the 27th Virginia, I think our best understanding today suggests. The crisis of the battle had arrived. Crawford's unexpected success in rolling up Jackson's left flank caught Banks, as well as it did Jackson, caught Banks off guard. And Banks was not able to maneuver additional Union-clad soldiers to reinforce his now exhausted soldiers under Samuel Crawford's command. Jackson rushed to his left flank as news reached him of Winder's wounding. Now, Stonewall found A.P. Hill coming up behind Taliaferro's beleaguered units and stopped long enough to admonish Hill for being late yet again. Then Jackson rushes into the chaos to rally his men. "Jackson is with you. Rally me, rally, brave men, and follow me," Jackson shouted as he grabbed a Confederate battle flag. "The escape of Jackson from death is miraculous to consider," observed General Taliaferro after the event. "He was in the thickest of the combat at the very short range." Jed Hotchkiss, Jackson's mapmaker from the valley, observed a surreal moment. "I recollect well his attempt to draw his long cavalry sword to help him stop the rout, when he found it so rusted from non-use that he could not withdraw it, so he deliberately unsnapped it from its belt and used it, scabbard and all, on the heads of fleeing and panic-stricken soldiers." For the only time on a Civil War battlefield anywhere, Jackson did or did not draw his sword. Now, I take exception, actually, with the normally reliable Jed Hotchkiss on this one small detail. I have handled, in the course of the years, dozens of sabers which have lain dormant for decades, and I've never found one literally rusted in the scabbard. What then would account for Jackson's action? It's possible, one explanation, is that the wooden shims that originally are found in these scabbards that are placed there to keep the blade from coming in contact with the scabbard walls, those shims might have fractured and, in fact, gotten wedged in between the scabbard wall and the blade. I have seen that happen before, and it takes considerable exertion to remove the blade under those circumstances. Now, if you were in the heat of battle, flustered and excited, and you attempt to draw your sword and it resists, well, Jackson simply said, well, the heck with it. Or maybe Jackson even went so far as to say something more stronger, but indulging himself for a moment. But he simply unbuckled his scabbard and used the whole thing for its intended purpose. At any rate, however it happened, Jackson's heroic performance was electrifying to everyone who witnessed it, and it accomplished the purpose of rallying his men at truly the critical moment. And equally as important, disheartening the opponents who observed it. The Union forces were not able to take advantage of their short-lived success, particularly now that they were grossly outnumbered with the arrival of Hill's division. And the bands were playing with the regiments as they arrived. As night fell, Banks' forces were rushing back towards the protection of Culpeper. Jackson, never one to rest after a victory, made a brief moonlight reconnaissance in front of his lines. gee, that sounds like a good idea. Well, it worked for him here. It wouldn't work so well at Chancellorsville. He sent his troops forward along the road to Culpeper, just beyond Cedar Run Church, where the Union lines had started at the beginning of the day. The Confederates unexpectedly ran into fresh Union troops under Ricketts' division arriving from that portion of Pope's command. John Pope himself personally arrived on the battlefield late as the moon rose from the east. He arrives on the field, but a surprise Confederate salvo from a cannon created an incident, something that Pope professed had never happened in the West, and that is that he turned his back on the enemy and sought a safer position in the rear. The two armies sparred awkwardly in the darkness until right around midnight, and the battle was over. Jackson withdrew from the field on the 11th of August and returned to Gordonsville. Although he had won the battle, he had failed to inflict what he had hoped to do, that is, the decisive blow against his enemy. The engagement cost Jackson roughly 1,400 men killed, wounded, missing. Half of those losses came from Winder's division, which received that devastating blow from the Union command under Crawford's brigade. William Crawford's losses then totaled some 867 men, fully one half of his command, 50% casualties, in addition to three lost battle flags. All of that amounted to a large portion of the entire Union casualties, estimated at right at 2,400. In hindsight, the aggressive Stonewall had not managed his advance to the field particularly well, nor had the tactical management been particularly well handled. The delays in his march to the field, the bottleneck near the Crittenden Gate, the lack of clear understanding of his enemy's position, all served to neutralize Jackson's overwhelming superiority of numbers. The general's secretive nature worked against him in this particular instance, in that his brigade-level commanders had just a very murky idea of what it was that Jackson wished them to do. His demonstrations of personal bravery is, of course, the stuff of which Jackson's legend is made. He is never more in command, if you will, than he is at the moment near the Crittenden Gate. In fact, Stonewall himself would go on record as saying Cedar Mountain was his most successful performance as a commander on the battlefield. After an awkward June spent around Richmond, the victory went far to restore the command's confidence in their commander. Lee, believe it or not, was beginning to perhaps question Jackson's ability to command. That confidence was restored, and this union that would last throughout the remainder of Jackson and Lee's time together begins to truly take shape. But more importantly, perhaps, is Jackson's confidence in himself has been restored. Banks, on the other hand, had fought well. No one can take that away from him as a commander or his men. And he had succeeded in fact, stopping Jackson's advance. Pope, in predictable fashion, brushed off this tactical defeat. One of Banks' lieutenants went on record as saying, "I'm sorry I can't twist the facts into a glorious victory." It was a glorious defeat, if such an adjective can be used with the noun. The day following the battle was the Sabbath. As the sun began to rise, Jackson dashed off a note to Lee. "God bless their arms with another victory." And that gets you to the battlefield. Now Rick Britton has to take you further. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.